What you should do is get it as soon as you can and in the most expeditious manner. If that means going in and getting the flu shot in one arm, the COVID shot in the other, that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that at all. In fact, that might make it more convenient and make it more liable, that more likely that you would actually go get both of them if you can do it conveniently in one visit.
Dr. Anthony Fauci telling everyone to get doubled up as we head into flu season. And of course, we are still in COVID season. Last year, thanks to masks, social distancing, and overall quarantine measures, scientists say there basically was no flu season. The CDC reported only around 2,000 cases between September of last year and April of this year. The previous year, the number of flu cases was more than 38 million. But this year could be different. Here to talk about it is Catherine Wu. She covers science for The Atlantic. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So you've had your flu shot. I've had mine. Are people getting their flu shots, or have they forgotten in general that they need to do this every year?
Oh, it's a little tough to say at this point. I have heard, you know, anecdotes of people getting their flu shots and very happy to hear that you've gotten yours. But honestly, it's still a bit early in the season for people to be getting their flu shots. A lot of people wait several weeks from now, even into November. Though, you know, it is a good time to remind people that the CDC does recommend that people get their shots before the end of October.
And are medical professionals worried that we could see a return to a more active flu season this year?
They are, though, you know, it's incredibly difficult to predict, which is obviously a familiar refrain during this pandemic. Part of the reason it's so unpredictable this year is because we didn't have good eyes on the flu this past year. You know, it didn't completely vanish. These viruses have not gone extinct. But as you just mentioned, we had an unusually quiet flu season last year. And that means not only that, you know, people weren't getting sick, which is a great thing, but it also meant that we didn't have a lot of samples to work with. You know, the normal way that scientists keep tabs on the flu and figure out what strains to put in next year's vaccines is by, you know, sampling the respiratory tracts of people who have gotten sick, figuring out which flu strains are infecting them, and comparing them from all across the world and saying, okay, this is probably what's going to pop in the fall, in the winter, depending on the hemisphere you're in. We just had less data to work with. And, you know, on top of that, because most of us were not infected by flu viruses last year, as far as we can tell, that means we didn't get the typical population level immunity boost that we all normally get. Like basically our immune systems didn't get their annual reminder, oh, this is what a real deal flu virus looks like. Please keep your defenses high.
So does that mean that the current flu vaccine might not be as effective as previous ones?
It's always a gamble. You know, any given year, the flu vaccine's effectiveness kind of tops off around 60%, which is not bad, but it's really not stellar, especially compared to our COVID-19 vaccines. And it's not always like more data is always better. Sometimes scientists are able to sequence just bananas amounts of flu viral sequences, and they still kind of slightly miss the mark. Flu is very wily. It shapeshifts a lot faster than the coronavirus we're dealing with. There are so many strains bopping around all the time. Scientists always have to take a gamble when they're formulating that vaccine. But, you know, I think having a little bit less data to work with this year does sort of throw a wrench into things. I don't think anyone is yet 100% sure how well our flu vaccine is going to work this year, but no matter what, it is always better to have some protection than none.
Right, because even if you do get it, you might get a less severe version of the flu if you've been vaccinated.
Exactly. And that is exactly what all vaccines are intended to do. You know, lessen the severity of the experience of the infection if you do end up getting one. Even if the flu vaccine is not a perfect match this year, there will be some overlap between what's in the vaccine and what your immune system actually encounters in terms of, you know, the bona fide virus. And that is going to leave you way better off than being totally unvaccinated.
What have scientists seen in the Southern Hemisphere, which has already gone through its cold season or is currently at the tail end of it? What is happening in Australia, in South America when it comes to the flu?
Yeah, so I think the some really interesting reports have come out of Australia recently, and it looks like they have had a pretty chill flu season again, which is encouraging. But I think this is also a huge reminder that a lot of infectious disease transmission is behavioral. It depends on how we interact with each other, how often we're interacting with each other, whether we're using protections like ventilation, masks, all of these things that we put into place super heavily at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Australia has been, I'd say, on average, more vigilant than the United States, which means that what their experience of flu season is won't necessarily be totally predictive of what happens here. Our mask usage, for instance, has been spottier here, and we did not go into, you know, super, super intense lockdowns, but it is encouraging. I think that's a signal that, you know, we could have a pretty mild flu season again, if we are pretty careful about it. And if we reinstate some of those behavioral measures.
Right. So masking, washing your hands a lot. How is the flu spread? Is it spread pretty much the same way that COVID is spread?
Yeah, I think in broad strokes, it's a fair comparison. Both of these are respiratory viruses. They like to hang out in your airway. And so when you're coughing, sneezing, speaking, just spewing little moist droplets out of your airway, that's what the virus is going to hitch a ride on. On average, it seems like this new coronavirus transmits better than the flu, and it transmits a little bit differently. The dynamics are different, but that also means, you know, the things that protect us against the coronavirus are going to protect us super well against the flu.
And what about hospitals? Are they gearing up for a possible increase in flu cases?
I do get the sense that this is something that a lot of healthcare workers are quite worried about. Hospitals across the country, really across many parts of the world, are already slammed with COVID cases. You know, Delta has really thrown a wrench into things. There are still so many people who are unvaccinated, you know, against both these viruses, and certainly being not vaccinated against COVID is the bigger deal right now. But hospitals cannot afford to have a double or even triple surge. You know, flu is not the only other respiratory virus that's hanging out there. We also have to worry about things like RSV, parainfluenza. But the good news is, again, some of those behavioral measures that we take against one respiratory virus has a good shot at quashing all of them. But, you know, all this goes to say is that we really can't afford to have a bad flu season this year.
Okay, so go out and get your flu shot. It is easy, it is free, and it's available at your local drugstore. So there's your public service announcement for the day.
Absolutely. It did not take me out at all. You know, I worked the next day. It was fine.
Okay, great. Thanks for the reassurance. Catherine Wu, she covers science for The Atlantic.
Thanks so much.
Meanwhile, when it comes to COVID vaccinations, pregnant women are not exactly lining up to get one. Even though the CDC says the vaccine is safe for pregnant women, only about a quarter of expectant moms are fully vaccinated. Joining us to talk about why that is Dr. Rachel Villanueva. She's president of the National Medical Association and a professor at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the CDC says about 1,000 pregnant women a week were diagnosed with COVID in June and July, and that has led to a surge in some hospitalizations and even death for some expectant moms. What are the complications of catching COVID while pregnant? Are you more at risk if you're pregnant?
Yes, unfortunately, we see that pregnant women are more likely to have severe disease, so more likely to need to be hospitalized, more likely to end up in an intensive care unit setting, needing a ventilator to assist with the breathing, and unfortunately, even increased risk of death.
Wow. And so despite that, as I said, only about a quarter of expectant moms are estimated to be fully vaccinated. Why are they so reluctant?
I think it's the same issue why people who are not pregnant are reluctant. I think there's a lot of misinformation about the vaccine that causes people not to have confidence in the vaccine itself. I think when women are pregnant, obviously, there's another layer of concern and safety, and they want to make sure they're not doing anything that might have some long-term effects for their child. And it's totally understandable. That's really what we do as obstetricians, gynecologists. We're making sure that women have healthy pregnancies. But we know that getting the vaccine is definitely needs to be part of that as well.
So do your patients come to you and say, look, this is a new vaccine. I don't know. Have there been any studies on how it would affect a fetus? There are just too many questions. I don't want to take the risk, that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I see patients every day. I ask the pregnant and non-pregnant patients if they've been vaccinated already. Many of the pregnant patients are vaccinated in my patient population, but a fair number are not as well. And then we go through why, what concerns they have. And I really go through really each and every concern and try to give them information, give them information that they can read themselves about the safety and benefits of getting the vaccine. I think another issue as well is sometimes it's actually the partner that doesn't want the patient to get vaccinated or the woman to get vaccinated. And I think, I've had partners come in for the conversation also. And I just had a patient a couple yesterday said they both gotten their first doses of vaccine last week. So I feel very, I'm encouraged that all of my talking mm-hmm. is doing some good work.
Right. Well, they do say that one-on-one conversations between a doctor and a patient about over a COVID vaccine is one of the most effective ways to convince people to get it. Are there any circumstances in which a pregnant patient should not get the COVID vaccine?
I don't really see that, but I think it definitely needs to be an individual conversation that patients have. But generally, if someone is at high risk or has some underlying disease that makes their pregnancy high risk, they would by and large be likely to benefit from getting vaccinated. But obviously I can't say for every specific, pregnant patient, but in general, I think there are very probably pretty rare instances where someone would not get the vaccine.
And
obviously, if they were allergic, let's say if they were allergic to some ingredient or had an allergic reaction
right.
to the first dose, then perhaps that would be an instance.
Mm-hmm. And what about after you've given birth and you're nursing? Some women might be a little leery of getting the vaccine then because, again, they might feel nervous about this drug possibly passing through the breast milk and affecting the newborn. But is there any evidence that the vaccine is unsafe for newborns in that situation when they're breastfeeding?
Right. So unfortunately, pregnant women and breastfeeding women were not included in the original studies. So a lot of the information that we're getting are information now for women who received the vaccine while they were pregnant, before they got pregnant, and we're getting information now from them. Interestingly, there was a recent study that came out looking at women who were recovering from a natural COVID infection, not the vaccination, but an actual COVID infection. And they had particular antibodies that were protective and neutralized against the virus that was in their breast milk. So that's very encouraging. And those antibodies lasted for up to 10 months. So that's great news for women who've had a previous COVID exposure. But they also looked and found antibodies from vaccination were also in breast milk. So also providing some protective benefit to the baby as well.
So up to 10 months, is that 10 months from infection or 10 months from birth?
It said, I think it was up to 10 months post, for up to 10 months post, I think delivery. Mm. I think it was post delivery. We're still able to provide antibodies in the breast milk.
That is great news then.
It is great news.
And so you're assuming that the same kinds of protective antibodies would be in breast milk from the vaccine?
Well, they're actually different antibodies. From the natural infection, they looked at just a different name, IgA antibodies, and then the vaccine gives us the IgG antibodies. But both are, they. And so what was important to find out was that the natural antibodies, the IgA, actually block infection or have that neutralizing effect that the antibodies that you get from a vaccine will also give you. So all right. Just some really good information that we, some research that we didn't have before.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to have some good news when it comes to COVID once in a while.
For once.
Rare. All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Dr. Rachel Villanueva, president of the National Medical Association and OBGYN and professor at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. Coming up, the potentially transformative elements of the $3.5 trillion budget plan being debated in Congress now. Could this be President Biden's New Deal? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, yesterday on the show, we talked about this big week in Congress as lawmakers try to avert a government shutdown, pass a bipartisan infrastructure bill, and come to an agreement on a $3.5 trillion spending package that could be as monumental as FDR's New Deal or Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. That's because the spending plan includes a major expansion of the country's social safety net. We're going to find out more about that with Jonathan Cohn. He covers healthcare, politics, and policy for HuffPost. Welcome back to Press Play, Jonathan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to go back to the day the Affordable Care Act became law, and that was more than a decade ago in 2010. Here is Vice President at the time, Joe Biden, introducing President Obama before he signed the bill.
Tens of millions of Americans will be a whole lot healthier from this moment on. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
Okay, so it's a little hard to hear there, but he's saying to him, Biden turns to Obama and says, this is a big effing deal. And you say that this agenda now before Congress, this $3.5 trillion bill, could be Biden's own big effing deal. Why is that?
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, it's very large, just in terms of the pure amount of spending. You get, we're getting into the scale of the reforms of the Great Society, getting towards what we saw in the New Deal, although the New Deal was really big. So that's kind of in a class by itself. But, you know, and it's not always easy to see what to do because there's so many different pieces to the agenda that Biden's trying to pass. But there's a group of reforms in particular. I'm thinking of the proposal for child care, for paid family, you know, to sort of essentially try to guarantee access to childcare to every working family that wants and needs it, for paid leave for people who need to take time off work to kind of care for other people, children, elderly, and then home care for the elderly and for people with disabilities. And I kind of lump these together, and other people have too, as a kind of caregiving agenda. And it's really quite transformative, I think, in two main ways. Number one, it sort of accepts the fact that these are needs we all have, you know, at one point in our lives. And to this point in our society, we've really kind of put that onto individuals. And when that happens, so many people can't afford it. They don't have the resources. They end up with inferior care. And it ends up, it causes financial strain. It's potentially bad for children. It's bad for the elderly, for people with disabilities getting these services. So that's one way it's transformative. The other is that it recognizes that this caregiving, this work, it has value. It has value to society. It is, there are people who are putting time into it, who are putting the effort into it. They are valuable people. And it starts to recognize that value by paying them more. Because when you look at who, you know, particularly the childcare workforce, the home care workforce, these are some of the most, what I would say, underpaid members of our labor force. You know, they're making, you know, what retail clerks make, what parking lot attendants make. And, you know, those
and they're mainly women doing this, and a lot of women of color doing this.
Mainly women, disproportionately women of color. And by the way, that is a big reason why they're underpaid. These are people who historically have not had bargaining power, have not had the opportunities, and we've been able to take their work for granted. And in effect, what these proposals say is that we will no longer take that work for granted. We no longer take that contribution for granted. We recognize that it's important. It's hard work. I mean, if you think about it, this is This is our children, right? This is our future. You know, these are our elders. These are the people who we have an obligation to. And we're recognizing this work is really important. And yes, we are going to pay something appropriate for that.
Mm. Right. And so in terms of this pandemic really laid bare the effects of this kind of thing on women and mothers in particular. And the idea that childcare and pre-care would be available to any family that wants it, that is huge. I mean, that would be huge for working moms, right?
It would be absolutely huge. And look, you know, this was a need before the pandemic, right? I mean, I think so many working families understood that. Any working parent who had to sort of find, you know, childcare was familiar with it. The pandemic kind of made the problem so much more severe, so much more visible. I think that played a big role in kind of thrusting it to the top of the agenda. And look, I want to be clear. The actual policy proposals under discussion. I mean, there are reasons why there are parts that, you know, if you talk to advocates and experts, well, this is good, this is not so good. You know, actually guaranteeing childcare to everyone is a pretty, I think even the most enthusiastic advocates for these plans would say, well, it won't quite get there. But, you know, in the same way that, say, you were mentioning the Affordable Care Act has brought insurance to so many people and has gotten us on the verge of universal coverage. I think this childcare plan, if it gets all the money that the advocates want, if it's fully funded in this plan, does get us very much closer to universal childcare, if you want to call it that.
Yeah. And then it would also provide up to 3 months of paid leave to take care of newborns or other family members, which I guess puts the U.S. in line with other countries in Western Europe, for example, who have that and more and have had that and more. Is this also seen as a competitive proposal that would make it would make workers happier and therefore more productive?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and you're absolutely right. We are a complete outlier in the developed world. Every other country has at least some kind of paid leave. And yes, I do think there is an economic payoff. And I think this is also true, by the way, for the childcare, for the all three of these. You know, they do cost, there will be a cost associated with them. The government has to spend money, has to, you know, to pay for people to go on leave. That's eventually going to come out of taxpayer dollars. But, you know, that there is a benefit to society. There's a benefit to corporations who also contribute to this. And that's because you get a more productive workforce. You know, it's easier to keep workers than train a new one. And, you know, you're talking about the business community over the years has, you know, there are many business leaders who say, yeah, we should have paid leave. You know, we should have a good childcare system. We should have a good home care system. There are a lot of economic payoffs to these initiatives, which is an important thing to consider because, you know, they will cost money on, you know, to fund these programs.
Right. And I guess that's the major objection on the part of some conservative Democrats and also Republicans, that it's just too much money. Do you expect this eventually to pass or some kind of version of it to pass? We just have a few seconds.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to make predictions. My guess is something will pass. What, you know, how big, how close it comes to the what the advocates hope, I think is very much an open question and frankly depends on how politics plays out over the next few days and weeks.
All right. We will definitely keep an eye on that. Jonathan Cohn writes about healthcare politics and policy for HuffPost. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
We are in the penultimate day of our good old-fashioned fundraiser. I love saying that word. And I get to do it during a fundraiser and pretty much only then, which means tomorrow is the last day. So if you've been procrastinating joining or renewing your membership, procrastinate no longer. We have a very generous challenge grant, so your dollar will go twice as far. It is time for you to go to kcrw.com/give and do your part to keep this kind of programming on the air, the news programming, the culture programming, all the great music you hear. I talked to someone yesterday who said, I can't imagine living my daily life without KCRW. It is my constant companion. So if that's true for you too, please join us and join this huge membership community that we have built. It's a great community. Dive on in and become a member at whatever level that you can. KCRW.com/give. Coming up, we'll get a preview of The Sopranos prequel. It's set in 1970s Newark, New Jersey, and it features younger versions of some of the characters you already know and love.
the main characters are loathsome, but also kind of funny and entertaining, and you have to make peace with the mixed feelings that they engender when you're watching.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for TV on the radio. Well, you know that song. That is the Sopranos theme song. And 14 years after the finale of that show, a prequel film is coming to theaters and HBO Max on Friday. The Many Saints of Newark is set in 1967 Newark, New Jersey. And it follows the formative teen years of the series' central character, Tony Soprano. Here's a little bit from the trailer.
On the basis of the Sanford-Binet, he's high IQ.
You can't prove it by me. He's got a D plus average.
Well, he doesn't apply himself, but he is smart. The results tell us he's a leader.
Joining us now is Matt Zoller-Seitz. He's editor-at-large of RogerEbert.com, writer for New York Magazine, and co-author of the book The Sopranos Sessions. Welcome back to Press Play, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Great to have you. Okay, is this also the brainchild of David Chase?
It is. It is. And it's funny because he, you know, they were talking about doing a spinoff movie while the show was still actively in production. And Michael Imperioli, who played Christopher on the show, told me that when James Gandolfini heard about that, that it, one version of it was going to be a prequel set 10 years before the start of the show. He said, what, are they going to have us wear wigs and girdles like Star Trek? But they obviously ended up going in a different direction.
Right. And actually, the son of James Gandolfini, Michael Gandolfini, plays him or plays Tony as a young man.
That's right. And it's pretty uncanny. I mean, he looks like him. He studied him. You know, it's interesting. He hadn't watched the show because he was so young when it ran that his parents wouldn't let him watch it because it was an R-rated show on HBO. And so his first full exposure to the show came after he had been cast in this part. So he watched all 86 hours of the series in one fell swoop to study his father to get the mannerisms right. And it's interesting to think of Gandolfini's work as Tony as a performance. I think there's a tendency to think that, oh, that's just the guy, that's how he sounds. But he had an accent coach. He, you know, he worked really hard on the body language, the posture, all of that stuff.
And did you get a chance at all to talk to him, to Michael Gandolfini, and to ask him how it feels playing his dad?
I did get to talk about that, and it was fascinating. He tried to get his father to talk to him about acting, about the craft of acting, because it was something that interested Michael from a young age. But his dad didn't want to talk about it. He wanted to not think about his job when he was with his son. And he told him something along the lines of, you know, I don't want to be your acting coach. I want to be your father. So, You know, acting was something that he came into just completely of his own interest. He was actively discouraged from pursuing it by his father.
Oh, really? And why?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know exactly why. And unfortunately, we won't get to ask James Gandolfini that question. But I remember that when the show was on the air, they were finished with season 3, I believe, and everybody was renegotiating their contracts. And I saw him at an HBO event, and I said, so when are they going to announce that you're back and you're going to do more seasons? And he said, I haven't decided that yet. And I said, that's wild. It's probably the most, if not the biggest show on TV, certainly the most important. Why would you not want to do another season? And he said, because no matter how long I spend in the shower after I get home from the set, I can't wash off the stink from this guy.
Right. And this guy and the series just became enormous. This is, many people say, the best show ever created on television.
Well, it's certainly up there, and it's one of the... It's the big bang from which modern television was created. And I compare it to Citizen Kane in the sense that Citizen Kane did not actually invent any of the techniques that it showcased, but it was It was the first major Hollywood production to put them all together. And I think The Sopranos was that equivalent for television. It took some of the lessons that had been learned in cinema in the 60s and 70s and belatedly brought them to TV. There had been anti-heroes and villains as heroes in TV before, but they'd never been populating an entire show. And it was never presented in such a way that you just had to sit with the contradictions and hypocrisies. There wasn't a strong moral center on the show telling you these are bad people, they're doing bad things, you're not supposed to like them. It was more in the manner of a Scorsese movie where the main characters are loathsome but also kind of funny and entertaining, and you have to make peace with the mixed feelings that they engender when you're watching.
So the title, I guess, is tongue-in-cheek, The Many Saints of Newark.
It's actually a direct reference to the main character, which is Dickie Moltisanti, who is a legendary gangster who was talked about on the original show but never seen. The characters on The Sopranos lived in the past quite a bit, and they were constantly talking about their own exploits when they were in their 20s and the exploits of their father's and grandfather's generation. So there was a kind of a gangster mythology that was passed down through the show, and it was often impossible to tell how many of these stories are actually reliable or even happened, because, you know, it's a show filled with compulsive liars and pathological narcissists. So you had to take everything with a grain of salt. But it was clear that Dickie was an important figure in the 60s. And this is, you know, this is canonical. It's not something that happens on the show. It's something that is talked about. But he died in the early 70s. He was killed. And we don't know anything else about that. So the movie goes into the circumstances behind Dickie's fairly short run as an important figure in the Newark mob. But it also gets into the changing times, just the kind of the new psychotherapy and sensitivity that was infusing the way that people talked about themselves in that time, which is sounds pretty comical coming out of the mouths of gangsters.
Right. So where did the saints come in?
Well, Moltisanti means many saints. So Dickie Moltisanti, okay. The Moltisanti family, and young Christopher Moltisanti, who was just a baby at the end of this film, those are the many saints of Newark. I think it's just a play on language trying to get us to see that this is not a story about the Sopranos, but it's a Sopranos story, as the subtitle puts it.
So you mentioned that in the original, in the Sopranos, Dickie was never seen. He was just talked about. I just want to play a clip from the Sopranos with Christopher talking about his death.
You know, your father was like a mentor to me.
Right.
Stand up. You ask anybody. Your old man was a legend. He single-handed hunted down our New England crew. Brought the war home to them up there.
So that was Tony and Christopher talking about Dickie Moltisanti. Dickie in the movie, the new movie version, is played by Alessandra Nivolo. Describe him more for us. How does he play Dickie?
Well, Dickie is it's a very tricky performance, and I think it's pretty remarkable how well he pulls it off, which is he's supposed to take this kind of mythological character, somebody that David Chase described to me as a phantom, almost like a character out of myth and legend, and he's got to preserve that charisma and that mystique, but at the same time make this guy a fully comprehensible human being. And I think he manages it. I think he manages it. And at the heart of this story is this kind of almost a sense of inevitability that's like something out of an ancient Greek tragedy or a horror film, where you can see what's coming for Dickie, but he can't escape his own fate. And it's sort of about his dawning awareness of how he is not only the master of his own destiny, but he's complicit in his own failures, and all of these things are kind of coming home to roost. And this is the same struggle that Tony is going to face years later. And the Tony in this film is not like the adult Tony that we meet on the show. He's a smart, impulsive, sensitive, imaginative teenage boy who has leadership potential, though not the makings of a varsity athlete, as his uncle would say. He actually, the implication here is that he had a chance to be a respectable citizen, like a person of some importance in the straight world. And Dickie is the decisive factor that sort of mitigates against that. And to me, I found this story to be quite haunting. I'm not sure what people are going to make of it. This is a movie, I don't want to give anything away, but it's a movie that constantly gives you new pieces of information about a lot of these major characters that changes your perception of what they're about. there's been a lot of debate and argument about the meaning of the ending of the show. And I will say that this movie doesn't solve any mysteries, but I will say that it adds some additional things to that scene that were not there originally. It doesn't contradict anybody's interpretation, which I think is nice, but it sort of gives you another avenue to explore, if that makes any sense.
Well, you spoke to David Chase for a big profile, big story in New York Magazine, and why did he wait 14 years to do another, I guess, Sopranos-esque production?
I think he kind of didn't want to be a one-trick pony. He didn't want to go to that well too many times. And also, you know, if there's one thing we know about David Chase from watching that show, it's that he doesn't like to do what people want him to do. He resists it. And if anything, he pushes against it. It was only in the summer of 2018 that he decided to go ahead and start work on this movie. And it was because he had decided that with the character of Dickie, he had a different way into the story. It was a different decade. Some of the characters were represented who were on the original show, but they were younger versions. They could be played by different actors, and they were supporting characters. And I think it's really interesting to look at the show that way, to see a bunch of lead characters become supporting, and then there's other lead characters who, except for Tony, we haven't met before. And it enlarges the scope of this universe that he's created. And it also means that characters like Tony, Livia, Tony's father, Johnny Boy, Silvio Dante, Polly Walnuts, they're not just TV people who were played by certain actors and we can never accept anybody else in the part. Instead, now it's like they're characters out of short stories by, you know, James Joyce or Christopher Isherwood or Ray Bradbury or something, where you can have all sorts of different actors play these characters, and it's fine. It's like, you know, how many Batmans have we had? I personally think Vera Farmiga's performance as Livia in this movie is as good as Nancy Marchand's work in the original show. And it's not the same. She's not just doing an impression. It's something new.
I was just going to ask you about that. So Tony's mom, Livia, was played by Nancy Marchand, and she was uniquely evil. And, I mean, Nancy Marchand was incredible in portraying her. Also, unfortunately, died early on in the series, the actress did. How does Vera Farmiga handle that?
Well, you know, she portrays her as somebody who loves her son very much and is not really aware of her limitations in expressing that. I found her portrayal of the character to be quite poignant, I think. And in fact, Vera Farmiga, when I interviewed her, she said that part of her mission as an actress here and also in Bates Motel, where she played Norman Bates' mother, and it's quite a theme going here, was to act as she put it, an advocate for the character. Like, she doesn't see Livia as an evil person. She sees her as a person who is missing certain components in her wiring that enable her to have a sort of a warm, quote-unquote, normal relationship with her children. So that's what she plays. And she's still funny. She's still sarcastic. She's still mean sometimes. But you don't hate her.
So you're a critic as well as a feature writer. And if you could put that hat on, how does this stack up to The Sopranos? I know it's, 2 hours compared to 86 hours. But in terms of writing and character development, direction, story, how does it stack up?
I think it's really good. I think there's a possibility that people who go into it not knowing anything about the world of the show will be mystified. But then again, I don't know. I mean, it's possible that somebody may see it and be completely satisfied and then go decide to watch the series. You just never know with this sort of thing. But I think what mainly interested me about the movie was that it presents an alternate way of entering the world of The Sopranos. It's not exactly a continuation of the show. It's, you don't even have to take it as sort of a canonical new piece of information. Some people will take it that way, and it's fun to think of it that way. But, you know, this movie is narrated by Christopher from the grave. Mm-hmm. So obviously, like, this is a show that was always filled with unreliable narrators, and now we have yet another one who's telling us this story that lasts 2 hours and takes the form of a feature film. And like, how reliable was Christopher during the run of the show? Not very. And even here, there's a lot of jokes at his expense for poor fact checking. Like when the time period jumps forward to the 1970s, he tells us that this was after Neil Young made that speech from the moon.
Right. Matt, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to talk about TV with you.
You too. That's Matt Zoller-Seitz. He's a writer for New York Magazine and co-author of the book, The Sopranos Sessions. The Many Saints of Newark premieres this Friday in theaters and on HBO Max. Coming up, what is up with all those Van Gogh pop-up immersive experiences where you can sit in a digital Starry Night? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, about a year ago, Netflix released the buzzy rom-com Emily in Paris, about a 20-something American woman who moves to Paris for her marketing job. The show was pretty popular and mostly panned by critics. But one scene in particular has inspired a new cultural phenomenon of sorts. The scene in which Emily, her love interest, and his girlfriend head to a big warehouse that's been turned into a life-sized Vincent van Gogh painting.
This is incredible. Starry Night, one of my favorites.
Mine too.
Did you know Van Gogh painted it while having a nervous breakdown?
No, I did not.
Well, now these immersive Van Gogh experiences are everywhere. Nearly 40 of them have either recently opened in the U.S. or are opening soon. There's one here in L.A. It's in Hollywood. Kristen Capps covers art, architecture, and housing for Bloomberg City Lab, where he wrote about this phenomenon, and he joins me now. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, is this all because of that one scene in Emily in Paris?
You know, those had been running across Europe for a while by that point, but that seemed to be the break in the dam once that show came out and was so popular. You know, certainly the producers who were looking to the United States really accelerated that timeline. You had suddenly five different companies trying to be the first on the ground in different cities with a Van Gogh immersive. So they were eventually going to hit. There was no way that we would be spared these experiences, but it seemed to really accelerate that timeline.
Well, describe what it's like. What is one of these Van Gogh experiences like?
They're all a little bit different. You know, in some cities, the producers try to find really established venues, try to get special places in others, like in Washington, D.C., where I live. It's at a former grocery store, a Save-A-Lot by the train tracks. Generally, there are different levels of kind of educational materials. When you walk in, you might learn a little bit about Vincent van Gogh's life. You might learn very little and just plunge right into the kind of large projections where there's some animation, there are the paintings, the blockbuster hits that you know and love, and those kind of swirl around for a good half an hour or so, and then you're in the gift shop. That is guaranteed across these experiences that you will exit through the gift shop.
And it is not cheap, right? I see tickets here in LA, they're from like $55 to $100 for the VIP experience.
It is so not cheap. You know, considering that at a lot of museums, you could see Van Gogh's real paintings for a whole lot less. These are expensive buys. They range from around $25 to, you know, into the hundreds of dollars for, you know, different levels of VIP experience or tours that you want to take. Yeah, it's a pricey buy.
And why Van Gogh? Are there any other artists that are being shown in this way, or is it just him?
Van Gogh is a special artist. I mean, we love, you know, his approach to the canvas. We love his brushstrokes. I think producers especially love that his work falls in the public domain and therefore is very cheap to acquire for the purposes of projecting small pictures really, really big. The producers for these big immersive shows are paying just for the rights to high resolution images. If you think about any similarly sized touring experience, you're paying musicians, pyrotechnic guys, whatever it is. The producers are paying a couple hundred dollars for the permissions.
So I guess they're raking it in if these tickets are so expensive and they're not paying much to do it. Are they really popular, these things?
They are raking it in. So the producers behind one of them, Immersive Van Gogh, you know, said that right now they are the highest seller on Ticketmaster. They passed 3.2 million tickets. And to put that into perspective, that's more than Taylor Swift sold on her stadium spanning Reputation tour. So this is really, really massive phenomenon. And that's only one of the Van Gogh companies. There are, you know, at least five, including one museum, you know, competing to put on these big spectacles.
Hmm. So also a museum you write about is getting in on this. And a museum in Indianapolis has given over one whole floor to one of these experiences. But it's not like museums haven't dabbled in this kind of user-friendly, crowd-pleasing spectacle in the past. I can see how it would be quite tantalizing from a monetary point of view to put these kinds of spectacles on. At least it gets people in the door, in the case of the museum, and they may enjoy the other art.
I think of a museum as a steward of a lot of work over a long period of time. So it is a remarkable thing, I believe, for a city museum to take down a floor of art to put up, you know, a kind of for-profit spectacle like this. I think that could be seen as a disservice to the people over many, you know, decades, more than 100 years, who contributed to ensuring that Indianapolis has a vital repository for art. And I can see why residents of Indianapolis and certainly art lovers are frustrated by that, even as many are, you know, crowding in to see this spectacle.
Mm. Well, let me just be the devil's advocate for a second. And what if the effect is the same, that someone comes into one of these experiences, has an experience that is filled with awe and wonder and appreciation for Van Gogh's artistry, and comes out of it slightly changed and more appreciative of art and feels spiritually enriched? Is that not possible when they go to one of these experiences?
That's certainly possible. You know, I think you can make an argument for sure that this animation is its own art experience, and that might be very well be true. But it is not the experience of seeing Van Gogh's painting, that magic that happens of brushstroke applying to canvas is unique, and it is the province of museums. That is where we go for that kind of experience. And specifically, they are, you know, they removed all of their contemporary art. The whole fourth floor of contemporary art collection is gone, and it doesn't appear to be coming back. So if you want to see contemporary art in Indianapolis, you are totally out of luck.
But you will see a Van Gogh of sorts. Kristen Capps covers art, architecture, and housing for Bloomberg City Lab. Kristen, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Time is running out. Tomorrow is the final day of our good old-fashioned pledge drive. We still have a lot of money to raise, so this is really go time now. And we have a generous challenge grant, $25,000. We'll get it by midnight tonight if we raise that by midnight tonight. So thank you to our KCRW board member, John Aoyang, and Lori Aoyang for that. So only hours left to get into this double impact opportunity. That's what I am presenting it as, a double impact opportunity at kcrw.com/give. It's really easy to do. We would love to have you join our expanding membership pool and become part of our KCRW community. You already are. Now let's make it official. KCRW.com/give. Thank you, thank you, thank you for whatever you can donate. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.